This is Pop Health Week on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm Greg Masters, Managing Director of Health Innovation Media, the publisher of ACOWatch.com, and your Pop Health Week co-host with my partner co-founder, Fred Goldstein, the president of Accountable Health, LLC, a Jacksonville, Florida-based consulting firm. Our guests today are from Humana, who weigh in on innovation in population health, specializing in the social determinants of health, such as food insecurity, loneliness and social isolation, and related transportation barriers. Humana's Bold Goal program is designed to support the needs of the whole person by, quote, co-creating solutions to address social determinants and the health-related social needs of our members and communities. Carolyn Coates, MHSA, is Vice President, Bold Goal and Population Health Strategy, and Andrew Renda, MD, MPH, is Associate Vice President for Population Health at Humana. Dr. Renda's focus is on social determinants of health insights, strategy, analytics, and communications. So, Fred, over to you. Help us get to know Carolyn and Dr. Renda.
Thanks so much, Greg. And Caroline and Andrew, welcome to Pop Health Week.
Thanks for having us. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have the conversation.
Fantastic. Thanks both for joining us. It's really a pleasure to get you on. There's a lot of unique stuff we can go into today. I want to first give each of you a little chance to introduce yourself, your title, your role with Humana, and then we'll move on into some of the fantastic work you're doing around population health.
Sure. Good afternoon. I'll start. This is Caroline Coates, and I lead Humana's what we call our Bold Goal within the Office of Population Health.
And hi, this is Andrew Renda. I'm Associate Vice President, Population Health at Humana. I work for Caroline, and I get to lead a portion of our population health strategy that involves our analytics and our interventions and our communications.
Well, fantastic. Again, great to have you both on. And I know Humana has really, as I like to say, jumped into this thing sort of whole hog and said, we're going to go and try to begin to solve many of these issues in population health in various communities around social determinants. So perhaps first we could start off, Caroline, how does Humana look at population health and the health of the community? What sort of things do you define that with, and what sort of models are you trying to apply?
Yeah, thank you. Great question. And I'd start with saying that our approach and our answer continuously evolves as we learn more. So the Bold Goal was launched in 2015, where we said we're going to improve the health of the communities we serve, and we designated about seven markets at the time as quote-unquote Bold Goal, where we really dedicated some resources in the market, spent time learning the community, understanding the specific healthcare needs, building some healthcare advisory boards. This all evolved into measuring our progress, where we latched on to the Healthy Days tool, which is a CDC tool. And since 2015, we've been measuring the health of our communities from looking at physical and mental self-reported unhealthy days over a period of time, and we track that. And that's led us down a path of looking at specific social determinants of needs and applying different interventions and pilots and programs around those. It varies by market. As we know, healthcare is local. So we take those learnings and apply them as applicable while also growing our Bold Goal strategy into other markets. So we are close to having now about 15 or 16 designated Bold Goal markets, but that doesn't mean we're not focused on this in all of our markets. It's really just, you know, a matter of dedicating that resource to building the trust and the relationships within the community. As we all know, population health is not just about one player, not about just Humana or just a hospital system or some community-based organization. So I think defining the fundamental of it is really important, where, you know, foundationally in all of our Bold Goal markets, it starts with the community, and it's really important to build those relationships. And then from there, we build upon that, like I said, with certain pilots and activities, and take those learnings and ultimately draw some insights from that can result in perhaps policy changes, benefit changes, you know, ultimately improving outcomes of the health within these communities, starting with our members, of course.
I might just add a little bit to what Caroline said. I mean, what I think about is we all exist in this really complex healthcare ecosystem. And by that, I mean, there's a traditional healthcare system of hospitals and ERs and pharmacies and things like that. And then there's the broader sort of ecosystem around health, things that are health related. And to me, that's in the community and do we have clean air to breathe and walking paths and access to healthy foods and all that kind of stuff. But sometimes it's really complicated and difficult to navigate both of those worlds. And so what our population health strategy really is about is about two things. It's about making healthcare and health easy for our consumers, our members, whatever you want to call them. And the other piece is helping people achieve their best health. And we think about helping people achieve their best health through kind of five points of influence is how our CEO, Bruce Broussard, refers it to. And those 5 points are primary care, social determinants of health, pharmacy, home health, and behavioral health. And so we think about those five things, and as Caroline articulated, our work, the work that our team does, is really deeply focused on social determinants of health and health-related social needs. And so it starts with a really broad world of many, many social determinants of health, and we've done research, both our own research, and we've done literature reviews, we've worked with partners, and we've kind of narrowed our focus down to some specific social determinants, things like food insecurity, loneliness, social isolation, transportation, and we've really, you know, gone down the path of developing, you know, analytic pipelines and intervention pipelines, and really tried to integrate those things into our business and into our care models.
What Andrew is really highlighting too, with referencing those 5 points of influence, brings me to a term that we all use, and you asked how we define and approach population health, and it's really around building a model for us all to think and work differently that's about whole person health. You know, we've all read the statistics that, you know, whether it's 60, 70, 80%, whatever number you want to reference, a good portion, more than half of our health is a function of these social components of our health. It's not our clinical. And while clinical is still really, really important, I think focusing on the whole person health and understanding these non-clinical needs of our members and approaching them holistically in a community is really at the center of trying to improve the health of that population.
It makes sense. And before we go on for the audience, you mentioned earlier the metric you use in all these Bold Goal programs, which is Healthy Days, a CDC metric. Could you explain what that is, Caroline, for those who may not know?
Yeah, so it's not a Humana survey tool. It's a CDC survey tool that's comprised of four questions, and I think Andrew probably knows all four of them by verbatim. I'll highlight two of the ones that really stand out. So when we call members for about half the year, every year, and ask these questions, and it's really how many days in the last 30 days have you felt mentally unhealthy, and how many days in the last 30 days have you felt physically unhealthy, and those are added up. And we track those over time. And while there's always noise in any survey and data, we find that this tool, particularly in measuring something as complex as population health, is really simple and it's sensitive. We've seen it react in markets where we've had natural disasters, and then we've seen the resiliency come back. It's robust. And so we put a lot of weight into the directionality of it that it measures. And just as an example to give you an idea, it also allows us to hone in on the populations where we may be seeing the highest prevalence of self-reported unhealthy days. So in our employer group segment, for example, we see on average they have a little over 5.5 unhealthy days a month that they're experiencing, whereas in our Medicare Advantage line of business, we see closer to 14 days a month of a combined mentally or physically unhealthy state. And then Medicaid, it goes over 20. And then you look at the social determinants of health, and this kind of leads into why we spend a lot of time around food insecurity and social isolation and loneliness. Those in particularly, if someone is screen positive for one of those, or we have a predictive model around that built, we're showing that they're 23, 24 days a month in an unhealthy state. And you start layering that on someone with a chronic condition, there, you know, you can quickly see the populations that are living most of their life mentally and or physically unhealthy. So probably more information than you wanted about the tool, but with the data allows us to really hone in where we want to focus some pilots and intervention. I don't know, Andrew, if you have anything else to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right. And what it boils down to is that Healthy Days is the gold standard health-related quality of life measure developed by CDC. It's been in the field for 30 years, lots of evidence that Caroline articulated. And so when it came down to us finding a measure by which we would measure ourselves and our bold goal of helping people become 20% healthier. This became really a great measure to help us define what health is. Self-report by design, it's simple and easy to administer. It asks a question about general health, it asks a question about activities of daily living, and then it asks those two healthy day questions. And we love that it gives equal weight to physical health and mental health. So for all those reasons, we selected it. Now we have 5 years of experience. Like Caroline said, we've done research on it. We survey our own members, and over time, we trend populations, different lines of business, different markets, et cetera. And it's proved a really robust, really sensitive measure. And it's really helped us hone in our strategy of population health, and it's led us down the path and helped us focus on specific social determinants that we believe will have the biggest impact on health-related quality of life.
That is really a great series of answers. I want to thank you, Caroline. You said you probably went a little bit too deep, but actually, I remember when you started in Jacksonville and I went to the first meeting for the Bold Goal here, which was really exciting, and they talked about this Healthy Day statistic, and to hear how you've now taken it and linked it up to all these other pieces and looked at it across your different commercial Medicare, Medicaid models and begin to track and link up those other pieces to it is really fascinating. It's something obviously we could really dive into over time. So thanks for that deeper explanation of what you're doing with it, which I had never sort of recognized early on you would take it that far, which is fantastic. So along with these programs, what you said now you're in 15, 16 communities. What are some of the areas these various communities focus on? You talked about each one is locally driven in a sense. So what are some of the areas that they're looking at?
Because we see such a strong tie around the couple social determinants of health I mentioned, food insecurity, social isolation, and loneliness being the most impactful drivers to moving that Healthy Days needle, I'd say globally we're focused on those across the board. How we approach them might be differently in each market, given market needs or specific healthcare needs. For example, you know, around loneliness, we did a pilot with an entity called PAPA, which I think many have heard of. Kind of their tagline is "Grandkids on Demand," where college students are matched up and make non-clinical social visits to identified members. And we actually used our screening data and predictive model data to determine where was the most impactful group of members for that type of a quote-unquote loneliness type of intervention. So we're still have some pretty good results on that, and to the point where we're expanding that across another 5 markets. And then in another market like Kansas City, we're in the middle still of a pilot that's going on where they partnered with some local barbershops, contracted with a community health worker who's doing on-site screenings of health. And this is not Humana-specific. This is a resource that's available to anyone that comes in. And I think it's an example of meeting people where they are. So sometimes you need an intervention where you're bringing people into their home. Sometimes, you know, we have other loneliness interventions where we're trying to get them out of their home into some type of community organization or physical activity group. And sometimes we have to employ a resource to meet them where they are, which is all examples of healthcare happens outside of the physician's office for the most part, right? And so we just have to continue to be nimble and test different approaches to that and meeting our members where they are.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think, you know, one of the things that we've really discovered in this 5-year journey for us is that it's an old cliche, but it's true. Health is local. And while we do have some national areas of focus that Caroline mentioned, food insecurity and loneliness and some chronic conditions around diabetes and other things, what we've found is, you know, as much data as we have, and we have a lot of it, we have claims data and pharmacy data and all sorts of things about our members. We've gone in at the beginning. We went into our first couple of markets and invited all the community stakeholders together in a big forum and said, guess what? Your problem is diabetes and your problem is this, this, and this. And these people raised their hand and said, you haven't asked us what we think our problems are, our challenges are in our communities. And they said, you know, an example is, yes, diabetes is an issue, but you can't go after diabetes until you solve behavioral health problems. You know, we have an opiate crisis in our community. We have a lack of behavioral health providers. And, you know, that's the root cause in some cases of why we have an explosion of cardiometabolic conditions. And so it's getting that local intel is really helpful. Another case, you know, while we've got a national focus on food insecurity, we've gone out and done some interventions. And a lot of times what we find is the reason those interventions aren't successful is that the root cause of the root cause is that people don't have transportation. So even if you provide access to food and food banks and things like that, if they don't have transportation to get to those food banks and transport the food back to where they live, then it's not going to be a successful intervention. And so we found that we really have to get boots on the ground. We have to engage with local, you know, stakeholders, understand and agree on what those issues are locally in that community, and then solve them together. And I think that's probably the biggest takeaway that we found in 5 years.
Yeah, and Andrew, you're just reminding me, I mean, so exactly to that point, while we look at some of the bigger, more common, I should say, social determinants holistically across markets, listening to the local communities on what's important to them and empowering the community and our resources there to go after that is really critical to that market. So like in Louisville, there's unfortunately a high prevalence of suicide. So there's a lot of effort in that market compared to some others around suicide prevention and training and screening and getting to the right resources. Whereas in some of our South Florida markets, we're finding that the root cause is stress and anxiety because of the hurricane season that they've been through. So there's been a decision to go even more upstream and focus more on emergency preparedness, which obviously more prepared can, you know, have a domino effect to some of those other social needs.
And I know in South Florida you did a unique program around food insecurity, and you also have these primary care clinics. Could you talk a little about that? Because I was really fascinated when you first launched that program.
I'll start it. I think Andrew probably knows a little bit more about it, but that was a randomized controlled trial study that is specific to food insecurity. And the hesitation here in my voice is it was one where we learned that it wasn't necessarily food insecurity that was the root cause. It was lack of transportation. There was a member engagement issue. It wasn't necessarily that there was a need to make members or individuals have better access to healthy, know where access to healthy food was or know what to eat. It was more getting them to the food or the food to them. I don't know, Andrew, if you want to expand on that one at all.
Yeah, I mean, food insecurity in South Florida is a really interesting story, and the story isn't over yet. It started, back in 2016, 2017, we did what we call an early learnings pilot, where we worked with a couple of clinics and we did some basic screening just to understand, what is the prevalence of food insecurity? And we were shocked. While the national prevalence is somewhere between 10 and 15%, in these particular clinics in South Florida, the prevalence was 45%. And so, clearly there was a need there, and clearly we could identify validated screening instruments and work with physicians and get them to integrate it into their practice. And so we evolved from that to the randomized control trial that Caroline mentioned, who said, okay, we know how to screen now. We know that people are receptive of food. So let's do this bigger trial and let's actually provide food. So we worked with Feeding America, South Florida in this case, and we created mobile food distributions monthly for a year for 1,000 patients. And we had pretty good engagement at the beginning, and then we kind of had this steady fall off that Caroline talked about, and we couldn't figure out why that was. We said, well, we know they're food insecure. We know they're interested. And we know they'll take food if you give it to them. But for some reason, they're not showing up to these food distributions. And it wasn't until we went in and did some interviews and we asked, and they said, well, that's great, but either I can't get there to get the food, or once I get it, now I've got a 50-pound sack of food, I have no way to get it back to where I live. And so that really made us understand that, sometimes there's a root cause of a root cause that we have to address as well. And so now the next part of the story is understanding, how do we either add a transportation component to a food insecurity intervention, or how do we figure out how to bring food to people, at their home? So there's different models to address that, but we're learning as we go. We don't have all the answers. We're just, we test and learn. We figure out what works. We try to scale it. We have learnings along the way, and we evolve as needed. So it's a very positive story, I think, but we still have a way to go to find that perfect model.
Yeah, so you keep iterating and figure out the next pieces of it. And obviously, as you said, these problems are very complex and there's not one silver bullet you can apply to them. The other area you focused on and mentioned a little bit earlier is loneliness. And that one has seemed to suddenly raise its head and get a lot more attention, particularly with the elderly. How did you come about sort of saying we're going to look at that? And then what sort of interventions can you do in that arena?
Yeah, it's definitely a harder nut to crack, and one solution for one person is one solution for one person, right? So this is one where we really need to keep an open mind and approach to vetting different solutions and making as many different options available to our members, individuals, and communities. But to answer your first question, why, back to the data. And what we had, and we also validated through some Robert Wood Johnson Foundation data, is that loneliness, I believe, was the number one social determinant of health that was most impactful to that healthy days metric.
Yes, we did a study that we actually published in Population Health Management, and with that, we partner with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We use their data set from their county health ranking report that ranks all the social determinants across every county in the country. We combine that with our Healthy Days data. And we looked at if you improved one single social determinant, what was the impact on health-related quality of life? And as Caroline said, loneliness, social isolation came out as an absolute number one opportunity. And that was kind of astounding because it's not something that you think about as being, you know, health-related. And it certainly took some selling to our senior leadership that we were going to develop interventions to solve for loneliness. It's kind of this abstract concept. But, you know, we took that study that we published, and then we went back and did some literature reviews. And we found that, you know, there's evidence that says that, you know, 45% of seniors are lonely. There's evidence that says that being lonely actually has a more harmful impact to your health than being obese or smoking 15 cigarettes a day. There's associative data that shows that if you are lonely, it doubles your risks of Alzheimer's and depression associated with higher healthcare resource utilization, ER visits and hospitalizations. And there's a very strong association with mortality, that you're two to five times more likely to die prematurely. So there was this preponderance of evidence that loneliness has this really profound impact on health. And so that really kind of solidified it for us that it needs to be one of these things that we really go deep into. So Caroline, you want to say something about some of the interventions that we've done?
Thanks, Andrew. So we have tested and continue to test a lot of different interventions. I mentioned the PAPA organization that we've now expanded to five more markets that really resonates with me personally. I have a mother with Alzheimer's, and she's very happy in her home. And I think of, gosh, wouldn't it be great if I could, via this app that they have, you know, tap into a nearby person who's been background checked and qualified and all that, to pay a visit to her, spend an hour, play the piano, you know, help bake cupcakes with her, whatever that would also provide, you know, feedback to me. And so that's an example of an area where I'm excited to see more movement in how we cover, I would say, non-traditional healthcare services, right? Covering services for something like that for my mom is worth a lot more than copay to a specialist that she doesn't need. We're partnering with some programs around fitness programs and community events and getting members to, you know, convene in those organizations. And then also using, we haven't really touched on all the screening data that we do. So we do over a million now screenings a year around social determinants of health. And then I just don't want to miss this point on loneliness, because we have such richness in that data. We've been able to use it to build predictive models around, specifically around loneliness, that helps us kind of hone in the, you know, certain populations to target. And then lastly, I just want to mention, I think there's an article in today's Health Affairs report around some of the loneliness work that we're doing specific to Humana military population. As we know from some data, just how the high prevalence within the military population, not only for the individual, but also for the family. So I think through our predictive model there, there'll be more work targeted toward the TRICARE beneficiaries through a new Office of Population Health that we launched under our Humana Military arm.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing up the military. Obviously, we won't have time to get into that. I've seen some unique programs that you're doing here in Jacksonville around that, both with feeding individuals and getting food to those and some others. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's just fascinating to me is you've used all this data to begin to really dig in and say, this is linked to that, and we can target this, and we can identify these people with that. It's early. Do you have yet some outcomes data? Are you beginning to see these things move the needle? We all believe they're going to do it. It's going to take some time, obviously. Has any of that been able to come up yet?
Yes and no. I say yes. I think we definitely do have some early quantitative and qualitative data on some of our specific programs. For example, the PAPA program I mentioned. So just looking at some of the data, even around the Healthy Days reported before and after, we've seen that needle move more significantly within that intervention compared to others, as well as the loneliness survey results. Tying it to utilization and outcomes over certain populations, I believe we've directionally correlated that one unhealthy day is equivalent to about 10 admits per thousand. So, you know, we start to see some pretty strong directional proof in addressing these social needs. I think you hit a really good point, though, that it is early. It takes a lot of time to to get this data and to turn the data into meaningful information and to draw the appropriate, you know, directional conclusions around all this. I think we all know that it's making a difference, but as we've said a lot of times, there's not one solution that fits all. So we need, you know, we're continuing to stay dedicated to it, trying more and more solutions, honing in on some of the most impactful populations to draw those conclusions.
I think what Caroline said is absolutely right. And we have to strike a balance. We would love for every one of our pilots to be proof of concept with, you know, definitive outcomes and things like that. But the reality is, to do that well, it's expensive. It takes time to recruit a lot of people. You have to run an intervention over a year. You have to allow for things like claims lag and run out of data so you can really understand the impact afterwards. Really quickly, an intervention becomes a 2 to 3 year process. And that's not really the speed of business. It's not really the speed of innovation. So often we'll start with a proof of concept, kind of a test and learn, just to see if a concept is will work, if people like it, and if it has directionally positive findings. And so that's really kind of the stage that we are now, is that we'll do a proof of concept with 100 people or 200 people. The POP is a great example. And we found that health-related quality of life improved significantly, loneliness scores decreased significantly, and some directional findings around the utilization and cost. As a result of that, now we've launched a randomized control trial with about 800 patients that we are going to run over a longer period of time. We are going to look at claims and costs and so forth, you know, and that will take more time. But because we have those directional findings from that proof of concept, we have more confidence that we will get those more definitive outcomes down the road. So it's a process, and we just have to balance that. We would love to have those types of results, but we also don't want to wait 3 years to have some indication that something works or it doesn't.
Yeah, fantastic. I want to thank you both for coming on today. Just a great conversation. We could obviously continue this. And also, Caroline, I understand that you and Dr. Schrank, as well as others from Humana, will be at the Population Health Colloquium. Both of you, I guess, will be speaking on a panel, and you'll be discussing loneliness, so that'll be very interesting to hear as well.
Yeah, look forward to it.
Yeah, thank you both, Caroline and Andrew. Really enjoyed having you on the show.
Sure, thanks for the opportunity. Sure. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It was great.
And back to you, Greg.
And thank you, Fred. That is the last word on today's broadcast. I want to thank Carolyn Coates, Vice President, Bold Goal and Population Health Strategy, and Andrew Renda, MD, MPH, Associate Vice President for Population Health at Humana, for their time and insights today. For more information or to follow Humana's Bold Goal progress, go to populationhealth.humana.com or follow them on Twitter via @Humana. For Pop Health Week, my colleague Fred Goldstein and Healthcare Now Radio, this is Greg Masters saying bye now.